Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar welcomes Dr. Terry Parker. Dr. Parker is assistant professor of hematology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Anish Chagpar.
Let's start off by you telling us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been here, what it is that you do, that kind of thing.
Well, I actually recently just joined the faculty here at the Yale School of Medicine. Prior to that, I was in New Haven doing my fellowship in hematology oncology through Yale University.
So tell us a little bit about what exactly a fellowship is.
That's a good question, as the medical education system can be a little bit confusing, especially when fellows see patients. So a fellowship is more specialized training that a physician receives in order to specialize in a particular area. So for example, once you finish a residency, which can be done in kind of general medicine, pediatrics, surgery, then you can choose to specialize and do additional training. For example, my fellowship was in hematology oncology, and it was a 3-year program that I completed.
So why did you choose hematology oncology? What was it about that field that was particularly attractive to you?
Well, actually, when I was in medical school, the first patient I ever was responsible for actually had an acute leukemia. And as a medical student, you know, acute leukemia can be a very challenging case, but I enjoyed that challenge and that you got to use everything that you had learned in medical school, from your basic histology to the patient interactions, to really provide good care for that patient. And I also enjoyed hematology because you really got to build up a relationship with the patient and their families throughout the years.
So tell me a little bit more about what exactly hematology oncology is. I mean, I know oncology is the study of cancer. What's a hematologic malignancy?
So hematology has to do with your blood. So hematology is often broken down into benign, so things such as an abnormality in your red blood cells, white blood cells, or platelets that isn't malignant or cancer. And then you have your hematological malignancies, which people look at as cancer of the blood, so to speak, or of a lymph node.
So tell me about your practice. So if you were seeing somebody with a benign hematologic disease, what might that be, and how do patients present with those kinds of abnormalities?
So I see a wide variety of hematological disorders. When you look at the benign, some of the things that we can commonly see are anemias or a low red blood cell count. Those are often discovered incidentally by the patient's primary care physician or family practice doctor when they're doing just a routine blood work for an annual checkup. And a lot of times, if someone does have an anemia, we work them up for nutritional deficiencies, which are very common. And many of our patients have things such as iron deficiency, folic acid deficiency, or vitamin B12 deficiency. So those are things if, specifically looking at anemias, although we also see patients who have abnormalities in white blood cell counts that may be just due to a viral infection or an abnormality in their platelets that can be associated with other more systemic illnesses.
So tell us a little bit more about disorders with platelets and what exactly a platelet is.
So a platelet is one of your blood components that is important for clotting your blood. So if you were to cut yourself, say, in the kitchen, cooking, the platelets are what helps stop the bleeding. So oftentimes we see patients who either have too low of a platelet count or too high of a platelet count. So in someone who has too low of a platelet count, the concern is that if they do cut themselves or suffer an injury, that they wouldn't stop bleeding. So our job as a hematologist, when we see these patients, is to try to determine what the cause of the low platelet count is. And sometimes we're successful, and sometimes it's what we can call immune-mediated, which is commonly seen, meaning a patient has developed an antibody that attacks those platelets and clears them from your peripheral blood. And so our job is to try to differentiate what could the potential cause be and how can we correct that platelet count back to hopefully the normal range.
So you mentioned one potential cause is your body making antibodies to these platelets. Do we know why that would happen?
A lot of times we see in patients who have other autoimmune disorders. So, for example, if someone has a history of an autoimmune thyroid problem or an autoimmune rheumatological disorder, such as lupus, for example. But sometimes these can come out of the blue, and people can say it's idiopathic, meaning we don't know exactly what causes it. We do see it more associated in clusters with other autoimmune disorders.
Are there other reasons why people can get low platelets, or is it mostly because of antibodies attacking these platelets?
No, one of the other common areas that we can see a low platelet count in is patients who have liver problems, commonly hepatitis C, as there's a hormone that your liver makes that tells your bone marrow to start producing platelets. And if you have liver damage, you're not producing as much as this hormone. And there's a few other reasons, so we do often see it with patients with liver disease, whether it's due to hepatitis C, which is a virus, or other causes of liver failure.
Do patients ever present with platelet counts that are too high?
Yes, we do see platelet counts that are too high, and two of the most common circumstances that we see that in is your platelets are what we call acute phase reactant. Kind of breaking that down, basically, if you have an infection or any type of inflammation, your platelets can respond to that and increase, so it's a reactive process. The other type we see is something that's called essential thrombocythemia, and that's actually classified as a myeloproliferative neoplasm, considered more of a malignancy. And so our job as a hematologist is to determine if this is something that's a primary bone marrow process or if it's just reacting to something else that's going on in your body.
So tell us a little bit more about bone marrow, what it is, and how you can figure out whether something is a cancer of a bone marrow or something unrelated.
Everyone has bone marrow. So if you look at your peripheral blood cells, so you have your red cells, white cells, and platelets to kind of break it down very simply, but all of your blood cells are made in your bone marrow. So you can think of it almost as a factory is where you're producing these. And so in order to figure out what's wrong with these cells, we go to the place of where they're made, which is the bone marrow. And we do that by doing what's called a bone marrow biopsy. And we usually take it from the backside of your hip, which is where there's a large amount of bone marrow. And we look at that bone marrow specimen or biopsy under a microscope with the aid of our hematopathologists in order to determine what the cells look like, what the precursor cells look like morphologically. So again, this is all done with the help of our hematopathologists. And we can do a variety of tests on the bone marrow, looking specifically at certain cell markers, the morphology of the cell, and also cytogenetics or if there's any genetic abnormalities, and putting all of this information together, depending on, you know, what your suspicions were prior to doing the procedure, it can help us make a diagnosis.
And so tell us a little bit more about bone marrow cancers. What are they? How common are they? How do they present?
So when you look at hematological malignancies, and if you're discussing bone marrow cancers, we commonly refer to those as leukemias or cancers of the blood. And when you take it in compared to hematologic malignancies or blood cancers with solid tumors, hematological malignancies are much less common than, say, a breast cancer or a colon cancer. And within hematological malignancies, you can have lymphomas, which more commonly involve your lymph nodes, but may also involve your bone marrow, and then the leukemias, which only really involve your bone marrow, and then the peripheral blood. Within leukemia, we have acute and chronic types. And the most common within this leukemias is actually chronic lymphocytic leukemia.
So tell us a little bit about the other type, which is lymphomas. Those occur, you said, in the lymph nodes as opposed to in the bone marrow. So tell us a little bit more about those. How do they present?
So oftentimes, if a patient presents with a lymphoma, which involves a lymph node, they may feel a lump or a bump, either in their neck region, under their arm, or in their groin. So often these patients will come in to their primary care physician saying, you know, this, I have this growth. I noticed it when I was shaving. I noticed it in the shower, for example. And from there, then they're worked up for whether or not this could be an infection of a lymph node. And eventually, they end up having a biopsy of that tissue that would reveal the abnormal cells.
Okay. So I understand that your primary focus is in something called CLL. Is that right?
Currently, yes. I do see patients with benign and malignant hematological problems. But one of my interests is the chronic lymphocytic leukemia, commonly referred to as CLL, and that's also my research interest.
So tell us a little bit more about CLL. What kinds of patients present with it? How do they present? How do they get worked up? And then how are they treated?
So most often, we are seeing patients diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, incidentally. So oftentimes, an individual will have a blood work done for a totally unrelated issue or just as part of their routine checkup. And in that blood work, they find an elevated white blood cell count, and the specific white blood cell that's elevated is called a lymphocyte. And oftentimes, these patients have no other symptoms besides an abnormal count. And it's usually diagnosed in individuals who are in their 60s or 70s, so later in life. And at that point in time is when we usually see the patients for the first time after they've already been discovered to have an abnormal white blood cell count, then they're referred for further evaluation.
And then what happens?
So once we see those individuals, our job is to confirm that this is in fact a chronic lymphocytic leukemia. In order to do that, we look at their blood under the microscope to see what the lymphocytes look like. You'd expect to see mature appearing lymphocytes and an increased number. We do a specific test called a flow cytometry, which allows us to look at certain cell markers on the lymphocytes to confirm that these are in fact lymphocytes that are involved in the CLL. We also look to see if they have any palpable lymph nodes, meaning do they have any lymph nodes that we can feel on their physical examination. A lot of times we will be able to feel a lymph node in the neck, under the arms, or in the groin. These individuals can also have an enlarged spleen or an enlarged liver. And if we're concerned that they have lymph nodes that we can't palpate, we'll oftentimes do what's called a CAT scan in order to fully evaluate the chest and their abdomen to determine if they have any lymph nodes that are hiding, so to speak, or that we can't feel. And sometimes, you know, usually we can make the diagnosis just based on their peripheral blood. Sometimes we do have to do a bone marrow, especially if we're considering treatment in these individuals.
And what would that treatment entail?
Well, the interesting thing about chronic lymphocytic leukemia is a large majority of our patients don't actually require treatment. CLL is a very heterogeneous disease entity, meaning some patients can go on for 10, 20, 30 years without having any symptoms and having very stable blood counts, whereas other patients can progress very quickly. So our job when we initially see patients is to try to determine who's going to progress and who's not.
So it sounds like some of these patients may or may not need treatment, and we're going to take a very short break for a medical minute. But when we get back, I'd really like to talk a little bit more about treatments for CLL, some of the novel treatments that you've got in terms of trials that are ongoing. So please stay tuned and learn more information about hematologic malignancies and CLL with my guest, Dr. Terry Parker.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Fortunately, major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam, and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses three-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Terry Parker, and we're discussing hematologic malignancies. Terry, prior to the break, we were talking a little bit about CLL, which is a type of lymphoma, that leukemia that you are particularly interested in. And you had mentioned that patients go a long time and may not need treatment. Tell us a little bit about how you know whether a patient needs treatment and when that treatment might be initiated.
So it's very different for each individual patient. So we really need to look at the patient on an individual scale and not kind of categorize everyone into one kind of category. There are certain things that we can look up to help us better predict when and if a patient's going to progress. And a lot of that is through cytogenetic abnormalities. And what that means is, do they have any chromosome abnormalities? Do they have an addition or deletion? So not enough or too many copies of a certain chromosome. So that's one of the routine tests that we're doing when we see patients up front, because that can at least give us more information to share with them about how quickly we think they will progress or if they will at all. You know, that being said, there are outliers to every situation. And once we have that information, it still doesn't change our recommendations up front for treatment. So if someone has a chromosomal abnormality, for example, a deletion 17, which is a loss of the chromosome on the arm of 17, we know that those patients have a higher likelihood of progressing and needing treatment during their disease course. But so far, studies have not shown that if we treat those patients up front, it doesn't change their survival. It would just give them exposure to chemotherapy and maybe the side effects that go along with that without any benefits. So some of the things that we tell our patients with CLL is things we look at is how quickly your white blood cell count is increasing. We call that the doubling time. So we like to see that white blood cell count stays stable over the several years. If it's increasing, say it goes from 6 to 12 to 24 very quickly, that's a sign that someone might need treatment. Other things we look at is the patient symptomatic? So are they having things that we call B symptoms or fevers? Are they losing weight unintentionally? Are they having night sweats? Are they having very massive swelling of their lymph nodes that cause them to be uncomfortable? So those are some of the clinical things that we look at and tell our patients to look for, and that would maybe cause us to treat them.
So you mentioned a couple of things that I want to pick up on. One is that you look at the cytogenetics of these cancer cells. So, and I understand that what you're looking for is a deletion or an addition of a particular chromosome, mm-hmm. but does this have implications in terms of family history? So your progeny, whether they are at increased risk of getting the same disease?
So these are what we call acquired mutations. So these individuals acquire them as they age. So this is not something that they would pass on to, say, their children, which we get that question asked a lot because that is a concern of our patients.
And so this is something that it's not really like you're going to pass this on to the next generation, but it's really a tool for you to look at these cancer cells and help you to decide whether to treat or not treat and perhaps with what particular agent. Is that right?
Well, it doesn't necessarily tell us we're going to treat. It tells us we may need to treat sooner, but not necessarily treat that individual. As again, we haven't seen any improvement, unfortunately, if we do treat these patients, you know, at the time of diagnosis versus, say, when they become symptomatic.
So tell us a little bit more about some of the interesting clinical trials that are ongoing. I understand that you're doing some pretty innovative work.
Well, I was very fortunate when I was a fellow here that I had the opportunity working with several of my mentors and now colleagues here at the Cancer Center to write and start a clinical trial from the ground up. So one of the things that we're looking at, and this is currently the only trial we have open specifically for CLL at Yale, is whether or not consolidating, and by consolidating, I mean adding kind of additional therapy after the upfront chemotherapy, if that makes a difference. So, for example, if someone with CLL were to require treatment, the standard treatment currently is something called chemoimmunotherapy, which is a combination of certain chemotherapeutic agents in addition to the immunotherapy rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody. So that would be considered your standard treatment. But we know a lot of these patients who do receive treatment may have improvement in the symptoms, but the abnormal cells don't go away. So you still may have a certain percentage of your lymphocytes that are abnormal. So our trial is looking at if we treat these patients with standard care up front, which is the chemoimmunotherapy, and in individuals who have stable disease or who achieve a partial response, if we give them an oral medication to try to consolidate that for a year, can we improve upon their initial response?
So this trial is really looking at whether, in addition to getting rid of the symptoms, that this additional therapy might get rid of these abnormal cells?
Or to decrease them. That's kind of the idea. So it's people call this maintenance therapy or consolidation therapy. Obviously, the challenge in having consolidation or maintenance is you want to find an agent that is well tolerated. You don't want to give your patients more side effects, especially if it's a medication that's going to be taken for a long period of time, such as a year in the study.
Right. One of the things that was interesting is that so many patients with CLL will present initially just with an abnormal blood test. They'll go to their doctor, they'll have their annual exam, and then they may be diagnosed with a cancer. What must that feel like for patients?
It's very stressful for the patient because they're feeling well. They're not having any, you know, symptoms. When you think of a malignancy or a cancer, most people think that you're pretty sick. But these patients, you know, they're, you know, going to the store, they're spending time with their families, they're doing everything that they would normally do. So to be told based on just one, you know, well visit, so to speak, that they have leukemia can be very devastating. And it really requires a good multidisciplinary team with the physician, the nurses, social work to kind of support them and say, well, this is the diagnosis, but this is something, hence the word chronic, that you can live with potentially. So you really need a lot of patient education and a lot of support for them initially.
Right. And what must it be like if you were a patient, you feel well, you've just been handed this diagnosis. Do you get a lot of patients who say, I know that you're telling me that I may not need therapy right now. I feel great. I don't have any symptoms, but I really want everything done. Does that happen?
It happens a lot, actually. It's very hard to have a diagnosis of cancer and not do anything about it. People, you know, want to be treated once they hear that word. And so, it does take a lot of education to, you know, make people and to educate them that if we do treat them, we may actually be doing more harm because they would have symptoms from the chemotherapy that can sometimes be worse than how they're feeling now. So it really is a lot of good patient education to say, you know, we want to give you the best quality of life that we can. And that may mean very frequent visits to the physician to reassure them that everything is stable and that they don't necessarily have to have treatment right that instant.
Right. So it sounds like you're really treating the patient and how they're feeling rather than the diagnosis or the abnormal cell that might be there that may or may not need treatment at that instant.
That's correct. And it can cause a lot of anxiety for patients But I think the big thing is to kind of work with them and to come up with a plan that the physician and the patient's comfortable with. Whether that's, you know, initially, for example, in patients who don't need treatment, we'll often see them once a month just to make sure that they're not progressing, not developing any worrisome symptoms, and that their blood counts are remaining stable. And if everything goes well in those initial few months, we can stretch out that time period to every 3 months, every 6 months. And there are even some patients who have had the disease for 30 years, again, outliers, but they come once a year. So it really, you know, depends on what the patient's comfort level is and the physician's.
Yeah. And I'm sure that it at least reduces some anxiety knowing that their physician is always there and that they're going to go back and see their physician and make sure that everything is okay.
It definitely does. And the one thing that we do stress is just because you have an appointment in 3 months or 6 months, that doesn't mean we can't see you earlier if you have something that comes up that's worrisome to you. So we take a lot of time to educate our patients on the symptoms that would cause us to maybe consider treatment. Again, new lymph nodes or lumps and bumps, like we like to call it, or fevers, or just kind of not feeling well in general. We encourage them to call and be seen sooner. And I think for a lot of patients, that reassurance that we're a phone call away definitely helps.
Yeah. You know, another thing that you mentioned that a lot of our guests mention is this whole multidisciplinary effort. Tell us a little bit more about that and how it works in hematologic malignancies and why it's so important.
Well, I think one of the main keys in hematological malignancies is what you're treating is the blood. It's not one specific area, you know, it's the whole person. And you definitely need your whole staff to really help manage these patients because they are complex. And we have the physicians, we have our nurses who are wonderful, both the inpatient and the outpatient, who really get to know the patients. And the patients always have, you know, a favorite nurse that they like to go to if they require treatment. We have dietitians who work with patients to try to keep up their nutritional needs if they're going through chemotherapy. We have social work that helps deal with, you know, things such as how am I going to get to my doctor's appointment, to how do I tell my family members about this diagnosis. So there's really, you know, a lot of people who play a very big role in taking care of the whole patient. And I think patients get a better experience with that team.
Yeah. And the other piece, too, that I think you touched upon and I want to circle back to is with CLL, the longevity is really long. We talk a lot about survivorship these days in cancer and cancer care. Tell us a little bit more about what survivorship is and how that works.
So oftentimes people think of survivorship of patients who have been diagnosed with any type of malignancy or cancer and once they go into remission. But really, survivorship and even, for example, palliative care can start when a patient's actually diagnosed because it requires, you know, following up not just for their malignancy and making sure they meet certain goals, such as when do I need my next physician visit, but also making sure that their other health maintenance doesn't fall to the wayside. So just because a patient is diagnosed, say, with CLL, you want to make sure that they're still following up with the remainder of their health maintenance, such as if it was a female, their mammograms. If it was a male, making sure their prostate health is up to date, making sure they get the correct vaccinations. So it's really, you know, coordinating care and making sure they don't miss out on other things because they're so focused on this one diagnosis.
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned palliative care and survivorship beginning at diagnosis, and yet we talk about this being, you know, a long time. You can have patients living with CLL for 20, 30 years. Many people think about palliative care, for example, being really end of life, and yet if that starts at diagnosis, it really isn't. Tell us a little bit more about palliative care and how that fits in.
Yeah, so I actually do have an interest in palliative care because I did a palliative care fellowship prior to my hematology fellowship. But palliative care really is more about symptom management, not end-of-life care, which I can think people can confuse with hospice. So we bring palliative care in to help with symptom control.
Dr. Terry Parker is Assistant Professor of Hematology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.